Two of Cincinnati's best-known skyscrapers, both former office spaces and one a corporate headquarters to a now-departed Fortune 500 firm, are getting cash to fuel their redevelopment. In other news, I just got back from an international trip, and I can tell you that once you get back to CPG, all you want to do is get home smoothly. The airport is adding a new service to try to make that happen. This is Above the Fold. We've been on a short hiatus, but welcome back to Above the Fold. We're the podcast by the Cincinnati Business Courier, where we bring you the news of the week and interviews with the people who make it. I'm your host, Andy Brownfield, joined by Editor-in-Chief Tom Demaropoulos. Welcome back, Tom.
Good to be back, Andy. Happy to have you back as well. We missed you here at the Courier while you were out.
I would love to say I missed you guys too, but I was among the mountains and fondue of Switzerland, so... we're doing things a little bit different today. As I mentioned up top, I just returned from a trip to Switzerland. In addition to Toblerone and a home fondue kit, I also brought back COVID-19 for me, with me from overseas. Yeah, I think this is the first time we've recorded this news segment remotely.
I think this is. New territory here. But luckily, you were able to walk me through how to put all the podcast stuff together. So we're coming to you. We want to keep our folders happy. We want to make sure they keep getting this podcast from us.
Yeah, one thing I heard in business is you're supposed to make yourself indispensable. So I immediately regret teaching you how to use the podcast equipment.
I don't know if I could do it again, Andy. I got it set up this one time. So let's just be happy about that.
So apologies if things sound a little different or if I sound a little different. I mean, my symptoms have mostly dried up, but the COVID brain fog is real. And Tom, have you ever tried to schedule an Uber before?
I actually have never scheduled an Uber.
You know what? Neither have I. And I just don't know. Maybe you've had the same experience I have. Seems like half the time when I call an Uber or a Lyft or any of these ride-sharing things, I get hot potatoed back and forth between drivers before one finally accepts the fare. It says 20 minutes away. Your trip, you'll be there in 20 minutes. Your driver's 4 minutes away. Then it shifts to a new driver who's 7 minutes away. And they decide to drop the fare. And then it's a new driver who's 13 minutes away. And ultimately, what should have been a 20-minute trip is now a 30-minute trip while you're waiting for a damn driver to accept your ride.
Yeah, that's got to be frustrating. And I think that's part of the reason why I've never done it is because I don't feel like there are that many Ubers running around deep in the West Side.
Well, that sounds more like a you problem.
It absolutely is.
So, and I'm sure I promise to tie back, but we are lucky to be so close to CVG. I remember hearing a report earlier about how regional airports are losing flights and many people are having to drive to the nearest large city when traveling by train. So, on the other hand, though, getting to and from CVG can be a pain in and of itself. Remembering where your car is parked in the budget lot, for getting your cell phone on the roof of that car, and having to have the shuttle driver take you back so you can pick it up before you check into the flight. CVG is trying to make it all a little bit easier, especially with the fact that it can be unreliable to get a rideshare to the airport. I don't know if they've picked up my own personal pain with the process, but they're adding a new on-demand taxi service called Z-Trip to help commuters to and from the airport.
Yeah, Andy, this seems like such a smart idea to have essentially a dedicated service always taking you where you need to go from the airport.
Yeah, Z-Trip's an on-demand taxi service, so it acts like a registered taxi, but also like a ride-sharing service. Is going to be an app that will allow customers to pre-book these trips or hail these rides. And the estimated fare from the airport to downtown Cincinnati is going to be about $49. So CPG basically lacks on-demand taxi service at this point. The current yellow taxi cab services that we might be familiar with, they're provided by individual drivers with a taxi license. And ride-sharing services like Uber and Lyft, they've really disrupted that business, making hanging out at the airport waiting for fares a little bit less lucrative as people opt for other modes of transportation. And Z-Trip will pay the airport $3,500 per month, as well as $2 for each trip beginning or ending at CBG. And traditional taxi drivers, they pay $3 per trip at the airport, and then they negotiate the fares by each driver. So Z-Trip's not anything new. I mean, they operate 2,800 vehicles in 30 cities, including at the airports of Washington, D.C., Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Louisville. And they're going to have the plan is for Z-Trip to have about 30 cars in the region that will be marked as Z-Trip taxis, complete with dash cameras, tablet meter, tablet meters and GPS tracking. 10% of that fleet is also going to be compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Tom, I'm going to ask you one of those Cincinnati sacred cow questions, one that there is no right answer to without enraging a non-trivial portion of our audience. Who has the best ice cream in Cincinnati?
So for my money, I have to go with Greeters. But I know there are other answers that are also correct.
How diplomatic. Yeah, Greeters seems to be a popular choice, especially among the White House administration of President Joe Biden. In fact, Jen Psaki, his former press secretary, was recently on SmartList, where she was extolling the virtues of Grader's ice cream.
Yeah, that's it is. It's just so good. It's a must. If you stop in Cincinnati, it's a must try.
So for me, it's a trick question, because I'm in a bulking phase, and ice cream doesn't have enough protein. I make my own using vegan protein shakes and the Ninja Creamy appliance I got for my 10th anniversary with ACBJ, our parent company.
Excellent.
But I bet you a bunch of our listeners probably answered Aglamisi's Brothers and Oakley is their favorite ice cream in the Queen City.
Oh, for sure. You know, it's one of those treats in Cincinnati that when you walk down Oakley, you know, kind of the square in Oakley, you've got to stop in and at least get some sort of dish of ice cream or at least a couple chocolates while you're there.
Well, they're undergoing a facelift now. I mean, the brand's about 115 years old. And if you look at some of their packaging, I could see why some people may think of it as a bit dated.
Yes.
They're working with East End agency Brandians, which has also worked with Skyline Chili, Papa John's, and Big B Coffee. And if you look at the new pints that they have, the container's a bit more modern. They still borrow from the pink stripes of the old look, but those stripes cover the bottom quarter of the pint, which is otherwise black and has the new logo, which takes on a different font. And Tom, you are of Greek descent. Y'all's last names aren't always easy to read or pronounce. So the font that they used for Aglamisi's is a bit easier to read while retaining some of the old character of the logo.
Yes, Andy, that is true. And I always say I'm a bad Greek because I don't do a very good job of I don't know very many Greek words, and I mispronounce other Greek last names because my last name's been Americanized. You know, originally it was spelled the end of my name was R O P O L O U S instead of L I S, like the Americanized version.
You know, that's something that my my wife's grandparents, who are Greek, when they were first reading the business career, they pointed out that your name was spelled wrong. They said the Greek's name is spelled wrong.
It is.
So Aglamisi's, this updating of their branding and packaging is being done in tandem with updates to its flagship Oakley location. And the company's also investing $1 million in a West End facility that manufactures its ice cream. Now, Aglamisi's, they're not like Grater's or UDF or other Cincinnati beloved ice cream institutions that seem to have scoop shops on, you know, every corner, at least in every neighborhood. The last time Aglamisi's opened something outside of its original Oakley shop was before I was born, when it opened up a second shop in Montgomery in 1970. But they've also hinted at new neighborhood stores.
Yeah, and that would definitely be exciting for other parts of Cincinnati, where you wouldn't have to be traveling to those two neighborhoods to get a taste of a Cincinnati classic.
Yeah, and you know, keep your eye out on store shelves for these rebranded pints. So I don't know about you, Tom, but I've always been fascinated by the idea of living somewhere that used to be something else. Eloquent, I know, but that's why I became a writer.
Yes.
One of my first apartments in Cincinnati was in the American Can Loss, which is an old factory that used to make canning machines in Northside. And the industrial character of the building just really shined through, and it was really cool to see old factory machinery incorporated in the apartment's design. 24-year-old Andy didn't really know there was a name for that kind of construction, apartment conversion, but it's really ramping up in Cincinnati.
It really is, Andy. This is something that I wrote about a couple of years ago, kind of pre-pandemic in Cincinnati, this idea of taking existing buildings and converting them into another use, something different. And Cincinnati, luckily now, in hindsight, was kind of ahead of the curve in this trend. I remember, I think it was 2018 or 2019 when I wrote the article. And about 3 million square feet of space downtown had either already been converted or was in the process of being converted from office to some other use.
That's a pretty staggering number, especially considering just how many how much these offices aren't being used for their original purposes anymore.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that's essentially three Great American Towers worth of space being changed to something else.
That's incredible. And in a pretty large, you know, maybe 10% of that total number, or a building representing about 10% of that total number, more than 300,000 square feet, is Macy's old headquarters in downtown, which, you know, up until 2020, Macy's was headquartered and then co-headquartered here until they decided to pull up roots and move full-time to the Big Apple, where they were kind of splitting time between. So a New York group, Victrix Investments, has acquired that building as well as downtown's Crew Tower, and they're working on pretty major conversions of both of those. You know, the Macy's one seems to be, if not further along, in a more advanced stage, where the Port of Greater Cincinnati Development Authority just approved the issuing of $60 million in bonds to fuel the redevelopment of that. Victrix is expected to pony up $72.8 million of its own for the project, and construction is beginning the fourth quarter and should be substantially complete by end of 2025.
Yeah, Andy, this is one of those projects that's really going to change a corner of downtown, I think, for the better long term. You know, without Macy's in that building, that's a lot of vacant space. That's a lot of space that's not, you know, that Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, isn't full of people who would be going down for coffee or lunches or happy hour. But if you fill it with people, that's a lot of residents who will be there activating that intersection. I think, you know, 7th and Vine there could use a shot in the arm like this, and this project could end up being that shot in the arm.
It definitely stands to provide a lot of density. I mean, they're looking at 314 residential units across 225,000 square feet, which would take up floors 8 through 21. And they would also offer about 100,000 square feet of common area, including an 8th floor rooftop terrace and top floor amenity space, as well as ground floor retail. Now, Victrix got an amenity package from the city, which will exempt it from paying property tax for about 25 years, and that incentive package is worth about $10.8 million. So, the old Macy's isn't the only high-profile skyscraper that Victrix is taking on.
That's right. Yeah, they've got, you know, they acquired the Crew Tower earlier this year, and I'm looking out my window right now looking at people doing some stabilization work on the building as we speak.
Yes, that one is an older building, arguably a more iconic building, arguably the most iconic building in downtown Cincinnati. And Victrix is in the middle of remediation work right now. And to that end, the port also approved a $1.5 million line of credit to help fund that remediation work. And that line of credit is anticipation of $6.4 million that Victrix is expecting from in a grant form from the state of Ohio. And it kind of allows them to continue the work that they're doing already while they're waiting for that grant money to come in. And that work includes asbestos removal, demolition activities, and roof replacement, among other things. Now, Victrix's plans are also to convert the Crew Tower to residential, much like with Macy's, and public records show off some of those plans, but those were tied to an application for Ohio Historic Preservation Tax Credits, which were ultimately not awarded. But had they been, that plan called for a Crew to be converted into 385 apartments, with floors 45 and 46 becoming amenity spaces.
Yeah, and Andy, I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't come back around for another bite at the state tax credit apple.
Yeah, we'll certainly see. I mean, how often does that kind of thing come along?
So there are two application periods per year. So there's one that will be announced coming up here in December at the end of the year, and then the other is announced in June.
All right, so we'll be keeping our eye on that. As I mentioned before, I got COVID. And I hate being sick. I mean, I'm the kind of guy who washes hands after touching a doorknob, or just use my sleeve or foot to open a door and avoid touching the knob altogether. I used to brag that I hadn't had so much as the common cold in maybe 4 years. Whenever I start to feel myself even being the first itch of a sniffle, I'd buy vitamin C supplements, zinc supplements, and I'd try to get as much high-quality sleep as possible. And God forbid I do get sick, I'll clean out Kroger's pharmacy in hopes of controlling the symptoms. Well, it looks like some of the stuff I might have been buying might not be all that effective, at least according to a class action lawsuit that involves Procter & Gamble and one of its alleged cold-controlling products. P&G, which makes DayQuil, and the makers of other over-the-counter medications like Sudafed PE, Mucinex, Sinex, Benadryl, Tylenol Sinus, are being sued by consumers over an FDA panel which declared that the main active ingredient in those medications, something I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of, phenylephrine? Well, this FDA panel said that it is not actually that effective.
Yeah, Andy, and this is the oral phenylephrine?
Yeah.
We're not sure. This is the oral version of the drug, and this panel has determined that it's not harmful by itself, but it's basically not helpful. It doesn't control any of your symptoms like a nasal version of it would.
Yeah, and so this ingredient grew in popularity after 2006 when Congress removed pseudoephedrine, which is a decongestant with a more proven track record. But it's also used to make meth, so a lot of companies kind of pivoted their formulations to use this other drug that is a bit less harmful.
Yeah, so Andy, I'm one of those Cincinnatians who, when the weather changes rapidly, I immediately get a sinus infection. It happens like clockwork, and I will tell you that I always have to go to the pharmacist to get the pseudoephedrine versions of these drugs because I know that will actually knock out my symptoms.
Yeah, and I remember as a cashier at Kroger, if people tried to buy more than I think it was two at a time, they had to get like special dispensation. We had to get a manager to come over and approve it to make sure that they weren't stockpiling.
Yep, you have to give your ID. It's a very, and rightfully so. It's controlled to make sure it's being used properly. But that to me is the good stuff for knocking out head colds and sinus infections.
So our reporter Brian Planalp, he's following this story, and he just reported that a bunch of these lawsuits that have been filed across the country are seeking to be consolidated into one class action that's going to represent all of the consumers who have purchased these products since this new ingredient's been used. So this next story intrigued me because I don't think I've ever heard of anything like this. And one of the best parts of homeownership, and I don't know if you'll agree with me, is having an attic and a basement. Mostly just to help store all the crap I've accumulated over the course of my adult life.
I'm with you, Andy. I love when we moved into our home from our condo, our first place. That was one of my. There were two things I loved having. One was a garage because I was parking on the street previously and hated running out in the rain or having to dig my car out of snow to get my car. And the other was having a basement where I could store all of my extra stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how often I'm going to use a belt sander, but I'm happy to have one. Tom, let me ask you this question, though. What if you're the type of person for whom accumulating crap, and I'm using air quotes here for the audience who can't see me, means a collection of cars or recreational vehicles?
That's a little bit different.
So developer Marty Liston is developing the Garage Condos at Mason Point, which sounds like an awful classy name for what appears to be storage units that you buy instead of rent.
Yeah, Andy, this is something that when I read this, I had never thought that there was a market for owning an individual storage unit. Obviously, storage units are huge business. There's lots of big REITs that are buying up large storage centers, but typically they're buying those because there's a steady income stream of people renting those storage units. But this is totally different.
Yeah, so the Garage Condos at Mason Point will bring online initially 9 condos, each spanning about 1,300 square feet, at least for the initial three that are being sold. And they can be used to hold things like car collections, RVs, boats, workout trailers, or if you're a food truck owner who wants some place to park it 24/7 with access, you could use one of these garage condos. And unlike a storage unit, these will be designed for people who want to be on site for long periods of time. I mean, if you're working on your car collection or you're working in your food truck, they'll have things like half baths or sometimes even full baths with showers and just more amenities for people who intend to spend a bit more time at these garage condos.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see the, you know, how this goes and if this is something that kind of picks up and, you know, if other people follow this developer's idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the first I've heard of this around our area. So this week on the podcast, we've got Lisa Knudsen, Chief Operating Officer of the EW Scripps Company, one of the largest public companies in Cincinnati. Lisa has made a career of transforming organizations, and in her current role, she's overseeing the reorganization of Scripps' television business as the nature of how Americans consume media shifts. This is Lisa Knudsen on Above the Fold.
You know, we've had enough people request to be able to have, you know, someone else on the podcast with them that we really should have invested in a fourth microphone or stand by now. But this is like, you know, the Fisher-Price My First Podcast set from Amazon.
We do what we can.
Do you want me to?
It's like,
yeah,
up suit to up.
Sometimes if I get too close, Andy has to turn my mic down. It's like I'll get excited and talk, and then the volume is too loud.
Well, my husband and I share a home office, and he has earbuds in and noise canceling. So you might have to turn me down.
No.
And my wife and I also share a home office, and she's always on, most of her team's remote, so she's always on calls. So when I work from home, I also have the noise canceling headphones on, then usually some kind of white noise or just like chill music.
It happens, right?
Yeah. So you have 9 trips coming up. Does your new role just have you flying all over to stations across the country?
Yeah, stations across the country, and then we have operations, obviously in Cincinnati, Atlanta, some in California, for the national networks. New York is where I'm headed next week, and then to Las Vegas, and all over the place.
So. Yeah. So Lisa, for our listeners who might not be familiar, this was kind of a big year for you. You've transitioned to a new role this year. Tell us a little bit about what that means and what you're doing at Scripps.
Yeah. So at the beginning of the year, we announced my promotion to COO, and that really means that I'm leading all the operations of both the local media business and the national networks business, Scripps Networks. So at that same time, we announced that we were going to begin a restructure and a transformation of the company. So if you think about it, Scripps has been in and out of businesses for many, many generations, and we are now in the media business from a television perspective. And our local media business and our national networks business are really more similar than they are different. And so having a leader look at those businesses, not just discreetly, but look at them in totality and how can we really maximize our opportunity in this ever-changing media landscape. So that was the premise, and that's what we've set about to do this year.
So, you know, all the big headlines in media right now are coming from the writer's strike and the actor's strike, and most of that's focused on the studios and streamers. Is that touching your business at all?
Not as much as certainly the studios. I think it could, depending on how long it lasts, could affect our business next year. Meaning, you know, all of the shows that are set to go live this fall were filmed and produced a year ago, right? So what you're really affecting right now is next year's releases in the fall of 2024. So most of our networks on the national side, not necessarily our news or Court TV, are really, ION is made up of procedural dramas, not first run. So we actually think potentially it could be a little bit of an advantage for us because people are used to turning on ION and watching, you know, many seasons ago and watching a lot of it since we're the 5th largest broadcast network in the country. So it may affect our business longer term. At the heart of the writer's strike is also residuals in terms of what they get paid for streaming. We are not necessarily in the streaming business. We're in the free ad-supported business. So it may or may not affect us from a cost perspective in the coming years. It certainly will for the studios. Yeah. So we keep an eye on it for sure. We also do some original programming, some that is done by Guild employees and some that's not. So, but we have not necessarily felt sort of the same pressures as the big studios.
Yeah. And with just the plethora of options that consumers have these days, from it seems like a new streaming service every week, and traditional terrestrial television, cable options, different packages, where do you see most of your strengths?
You know, it's I think what we call an all of the above strategy. You've heard Adam Simpson say that for a long time. We have a leg in each marketplace. We have a leg in cable. We have a leg in free over the air, the growing marketplace where you can, you know, plug in a digital antenna and get probably in Cincinnati 30 plus stations for free. And you can watch NFL games, you can watch, most sports that are broadcast on over the air. We also have, over the last couple of years, really established our ground in free ad-supported. So that's everything from Roku to Samsung Plus TV to Amazon Freevee, so on and so forth. So we have a little, we're in each of those marketplaces. As things are shifting in the media landscape, having a leg of the stool in each of those marketplaces is smart. People are still cutting the cord, and so free ad-supported is a way for individuals to cut their cable bill. Now they can plug in a digital antenna, receive 30 plus stations, including live sports, for free, and then they select, we call it self-bundling, right? So now I create my own bundle. I want free over-the-air television, but I also want Netflix, and I want maybe HBO Max or Max Now, and I can curate to my budget and also my viewing patterns, and I can cancel those things at any time and sign up for the next one, you know, depending on if Ted Lasso's on or if something else is on. So we really feel well positioned to be able to capture the growth that's happening in over the air, the growth that's happening in free ad supported and streaming. At the same time, whether it's political advertising or even big brands, they still advertise and want to advertise on national television because the reach of broadcasting is still the best way to reach consumers and to get those brands in front of consumers. So we, with the acquisition of ION a few years ago, we are the fifth largest broadcast network in the country, so we have great reach across 97% of the country we reach. And at the same time, we have the depth of our local markets. So if you're an advertiser and you want to buy something that reaches audiences nationally, we can do that. If you want to reach 85% of the households in Florida, guess what? We have 85% of the households in Florida covered for you. So I think we're a real nice option from an advertising perspective, but also from a consumer perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. What about sports? So that seems to be, you know, when I kind of look at the media landscape, sports continues to be kind of a highlight because it's live and it's people have to watch it kind of when it's on. So what has been Scripps, you know, strategy with sports, and where do you see that going?
Yeah, so we announced late last year that we stood up Scripps Sports, which is exactly that, trying to capture the opportunity in this changing landscape and environment, both at the national level, but also at the local level. And so I'm gonna start actually with the local level because I think the dynamics of that marketplace are changing very rapidly. You know Bally's and what's happening with Bally's and whether or not teams are actually going to have an outlet for their sports teams to be seen in their local markets this fall with hockey and the NBA and MLB for sure. It's not known. There's speculation that Bally's could file for or be gone by the middle of September.
Yeah.
And so with that at play, we are getting lots of inbounds for sure. We announced probably several months ago that we will be the home of the Vegas Golden Knights for hockey this fall. So that's one that we've already inked a deal on. And what we did in that case, which again speaks to sort of utilizing all of our assets, not siloed in two different divisions, but thinking about them more broadly, we had an ION station in that market, and we also had a local television station in that market. And so what we did is basically moved ION off of the primary channel to the dot two, and we stood up a brand new local television station in that market. It will have local news from our local news station. It will have Scripps News, which is our national news product. It will have Scripps Sports through the Vegas Golden Knights. And we've acquired programming that we can use on other stations across the country if necessary. So we've created a whole new station on the back of that sports deal that will, we think, is going to be terrific. It's terrific for the consumers in those markets because now 100% of that market can see sports.
Yeah, because that seems to be the biggest complaint. It's like it's too hard to find my team. It's right. It's not easy or it's expensive when you want to be able to watch as many or all of their games as possible.
So I'll use Cincinnati, for instance. You know, I'm a big Reds fan. And, you know, it's on a cable tier that's a paid. You have to pay extra for that cable tier. So maybe 30% of the audience in Cincinnati can see the Reds. We provide, as a local broadcaster, an option to be able to be seen by every single person in a market, either through free over-the-air television or through your cable bundle, mm-hmm. right? And so we really do think that teams will are gravitating to local broadcasting in particular to be able to give the fans what they want in a local market.
So is the kind of thing you guys are doing with the Golden Knights, is that something you see that's replicable in other markets?
I think so, most definitely. And we certainly don't have any news to break, but we're certainly looking through and modeling other markets as teams really scramble to figure out how they're going to be seen over the air in their marketplace.
Because it seems like, to me, that's a place advertisers like to be.
Definitely. Live sports, and especially quality live sports, the great thing about the Vegas Golden Knights is they just won the Stanley Cup. So, like, to then a month later announce that we are, like, the home of the Golden Knights is terrific. And so premium advertising dollars follow those premium sports for sure.
And it sounds like advertising-based media is still very healthy, where it seems like a lot of the more subscription-based streaming services are fighting for the same slice of the pie and even offering more ad-supported tiers to try to draw in more people.
Yeah. So that was, you know, Netflix said for a long time they would never offer an advertising tier until it became necessary for them to offer an advertising tier. And I would tell you, studies find that consumers, especially in these days and time with inflation and, you know, just tightening budgets at home, they are willing to sit through commercials and pay less. And so that's the beauty of our model is free. You know, we're like the leader in free TV, both over the air and through our FAST channels. So I do think that advertising, certainly the national advertising marketplace over the last year has struggled just because of inflation and honestly the war in Ukraine, the just the malaise of just in terms of whether or not we're in a recession or not in a recession, but certainly we have seen, you know, local, you know, while national may have been under pressure, local has continued to thrive, especially with the live sports being seen on those. And so I think, you know, advertising is still billions of dollars, and now they just have more places to place those dollars. The other thing I want to say is on streaming services where they have ad-supported tiers, a lot of that advertising is what they call programmatic advertising. So it is not sold directly to a client, and clients probably prefer to buy it programmatically because it takes away the friction of having to call, you know, Scripps and say, I want to buy Ion and I want to buy Grit and I want to buy Bounce. They can just buy in the programmatic marketplace, and honestly, the advertising rates that they're paying are similar. So the problem is with streamers, they don't have the reach that broadcasting has. When you can reach 97% of the country versus a Netflix or a Disney Plus or a Max, where you have, you know, 25 million subscribers, or like not all 25 million subscribers are watching the exact same show at the exact same time, unlike the Super Bowl or unlike the World Series or the NBA Finals. So that's the problem that advertisers and why they keep gravitating back to broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I think with the programmatic side of advertising too, at least personally, anecdotally to me, it feels like I'm fed the same advertisement over and over and over every single break. And if I see Franklin University one more time, I'm going to beat my head into the wall.
I'm with you. I won't say the name of the brand, but I saw the same car commercial like 5 times in a commercial break. And I'm like, I will never buy that car because I'm like so tired of seeing that advertisement.
Yeah.
That's part of the problem, right, with programmatic sort of digitally inserted advertising. They don't have the same yet. I'm sure it'll come at some point where they don't show you the same ad in the 6 ad breaks that are between, you know, the commercial ad breaks. But right now they still haven't figured that out.
Yeah. So you, before Scripps, were at Fifth Third, and how did you make the jump from banking to media, and how'd that find you?
Well, honestly, I was 18 years ago at Fifth Third, and it was fortuitous. I had helped my role at Fifth Third prior to coming to Scripps. I had helped run a large-scale transformation of a particular department there, and I was at Starbucks over in the 580 building, and someone that I knew in the community said, oh my gosh, I was just thinking about you. She had just joined Scripps, and she said, would you ever think of leaving Fifth Third and coming over to Scripps? And at the time, we were big Scripps, meaning we owned HGTV and the Food Network, and I am like total fan of both of those. So I made the switch, honestly, because I love the brand so much. And then within 2 years, not even 2 years, a year and a half of me joining Scripps, the CFO came to me and said, hey, we're separating the company and spinning off Scripps
Networks.
The networks business. Would you help to lead that project? Because I had experience leading large-scale projects. And it was one of those moments where you really have to soul search for, like, this is a big risk personally, and it's really honestly what changed my career, saying yes to that project. We did separate the company in about 8 months, spun off Scripps Networks, and then I stayed with Scripps, worked for Rich Bainey for 10 plus years in a variety of different roles, and it was really the scariest and the best decision I ever made.
So it sounds like you've kind of found a niche in big transformations.
Yeah. I love the fact since 2005, really, when we spun off Networks in 2008, I've really had a front row seat and maybe even have led most of those transformations along with a wonderful team of people. You know, that's why I have stayed at Scripps as long as I have, is because I have had the ability and personally to have lots of different careers within one company and to help lead really how the business will change and transform and be around for many generations. And to leave that kind of a legacy in a company is an amazing place to be.
Yeah. So Lisa, for you, what are the things that would keep you up at night when you're working on something of that scale? Or was there anything that you know, had you pacing the floor at midnight?
Yeah, I think it is, you know, there are things in your control and there's things out of your control, right, in any type of transformation. But hearkening way back to 2008, you know, you have regulatory, you know, approvals, you have all kinds of things that have to happen for it to go right. And those are the things that I probably mostly worry about, or the things sort of out of my control, and making sure we have plan B, C, and D in place. And then, like, I'm a big believer in having a really good plan, taking time to plan how you're going to approach, and from a change management perspective, how you're going to approach things. You know, fail to plan or plan to fail is, you know, the old saying. And I really do believe that if you have a good plan in place and trust the process, then things will work out. But you have to wrap all of that in really good communication and change management, especially with employees as you're working through that.
Excellent. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Buffer Folds is a podcast by the Cincinnati Business Courier, hosted by me, Andy Brownfield, and Tom Demeropoulos. The podcast is produced and edited by me, and our theme music was written by Dylan McCartney. Come back next week for another edition of Above the Fold.